Lord, thank you for this fellowship, this family, and the way we can support one another in many, many different ways. And one of the ways is to pray for each other. And so we do lift Carolyn before you tonight and ask that even though we don't know all the circumstances surrounding her condition, you do. And I just pray as the great physician and the healer that you would touch her, that you would give strength to her body and especially give strength and comfort to her soul and to the hearts of her family who will be joining her very soon. And Lord, I pray that you would open our hearts and our minds tonight to whatever it is you have to say to us. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we are going to actually wrap up our little four-part series that we did on God and government. This has been a real encouraging and eye-opening series for me. Man, I have enjoyed it. I hope you have too. And tonight, it's really, really interesting because we're going to be looking at a lot of the national monuments around our Capitol Mall, our National Mall, and what they have to tell us about who we are as a people, where we've come from, and we'll see a stark illustration of where we've ended up, why we are where we are. And some of you might be wondering, man, tonight, another history lesson, last week was a history lesson. Why are we studying American history? I thought I came here to hear the Bible. Well, you did. And as we pointed out over and over again, there is no departments of religion and a department of secular. It's all part of the same thing and the same life. Woodrow Wilson said this. He said, "A nation that does not remember what it was yesterday does not know what it is today, nor what it's trying to do." Thomas Jefferson said that the main value of studying the past, studying history, is rendering the people the safe or the vault, as they are the ultimate guardians of their own liberty. History, by apprising them of the past, will enable them to be a judge of the future. In other words, we need to know where we've come from in order to know where we should go. And you know, that's really not a new thing either. We read that that's what caused the nation Israel so much pain and sorrow back in the Old Testament. In Judges chapter 2, verses 10 through 12, we read a very, very sad commentary on Israel. And this commentary could easily be written about us in America today. After that whole generation, it says, had been gathered to their ancestors. In other words, after the generation of Moses and Joshua died, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord or what he had done for Israel. And it got him in a lot of trouble. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshiped various gods of the people around them. They aroused the Lord's anger. And if you read through Judges, man, it is not a pretty picture. It caused them a great deal of pain and sorrow and suffering. Last week, Noah presented the words of our founding fathers in a lot of their writings and speeches and that. And their words give evidence to the fact of their belief in God, in the Creator. And from his message, it's clear that they saw the world through the lens of the Bible. That's why I believe they framed the country and our Constitution the way they did. Their distrust of centralized power, any centralized power, be it the church or the state, was really based on their understanding of the fall of man. Went clear back to Genesis chapter 3. They understood clearly that in order to be a free people, we had to remain a moral people because freedom requires internal restraint. Even the free market system, capitalism, requires the exercise of internal restraint if it's going to last. John Adams, second president of the United States, warned our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. And then he said this in a letter in April 15th, 1814, "Democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes and exhausts and murders itself. There it was never a democracy that did not commit suicide. Wow, that's a pretty stark warning, isn't it? Now, this isn't a new idea. It goes all the way back to the garden. Genesis chapter 2, God, it's the retelling of the creation story. And verse 8 says that the Lord God planted a garden in the east in Eden, and there he put the man he had formed. The Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. In the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Verse 15, the Lord took the man and put him in the garden of Eden to work it and to take care of it. He put him in charge of all of it. He gave it all to him. And the Lord God commanded the man, "You are free. Eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat from it, you will certainly die." What he does is he sets the parameters for man's behavior. And he says, do anything you want. You are free to move about, like the Southwest Airlines commercial, anywhere within these parameters. Just stay in here. That's all you've got to do. Well, I think that is really freedom under the authority of God as he originally designed us to live. That's his original intent for us. But Satan, his archenemy, comes along and makes it feel like that is a totally unreasonable restriction. And so he says, in essence, if you just step out from under this oppressive authority, then you'll really be free. And the results, as you read through the book of Genesis, produced anything but freedom. It caused separation and division between man and God, between man and one another. It brought in death and violence and oppression of the weak by the strong. Now, the belief that God is the source of America's liberty really permeates the writers and the speeches, as Noah pointed out last week, of the Founding Fathers. It is also literally written into the rock and the mortar and the marble of our national monuments that dot the landscape of our capital. And so tonight I want to show you some of them, and this is, I'm just going to show you a few. It's widespread, and there's a lot more, but we don't have time to cover all of them. First, let's look at the Capitol building. As Clavin would say, you know, it's a little known fact, and I bet you're not aware, unless you've done some reading in history, that the Capitol of the United States of America was the first megachurch in America, and it continued for almost 100 years. By 1857, almost 2,000 people attended church in the hall of the U.S. House of Representatives. Four churches met in the Capitol. As Commander-in-Chief, Thomas Jefferson decided to help the worship services by ordering the Marine Corps Band to play the worship services. How cool is that? The Marine Corps Band is your praise band. Watch this clip and just look at what our Capitol is about.
Human government is more or less perfect as it approaches nearer or diverges farther from the imitation of this perfect plan of divine and moral government. John Adams.
No structure defines Washington more than the United States Capitol. Many of our greatest national leaders and thinkers have served under its great dome.
The building was very impressive not only to Americans, but also to foreign visitors. So people like Alexis de Tocqueville and Charles Dickens and Fanny Trollope sat in the galleries of the House and the Senate. In addition to reporting on the debates they heard, they talked about how impressive the chambers were and how they reflected well on this very young republic.
Upon entering the Capitol, visitors see a rotunda filled with religious imagery and inscriptions.
Throughout the building, you'll see signs of religious history, from the pilgrims praying to Pocahontas being baptized to scenes of religious leaders. So Moses is depicted as one of the great lawgivers in the House of Representatives chambers, but so is Suleiman, who is a Muslim, and so are people who we would consider pagans today, as well as popes and others who had religious affiliations.
The founders felt that religion was very important and that it should be practiced in the public square. It was just a matter of not preferring one religion over another or prescribing something as the, quote, official, unquote, religion of the federal government.
When Jefferson became president in 1800, there were really only two churches in Washington, D.C., and the house chaplain thought that perhaps since the house chamber was a fairly large room, that it could be made available to church services on Sunday. And so beginning in the fall of 1800, they began holding church services in the house chamber.
There was no hesitation on the part of Thomas Jefferson and others to use government facilities for religious purposes as long as they would be made available on an equal basis for anyone who wanted to use them. And that's why Thomas Jefferson himself felt it appropriate to have religious services in the Capitol, to which he faithfully attended.
James Madison also attended church services in the Capitol. Madison clearly saw no conflict between favoring religious observances in public spaces and opposing an official national religion.
Whilst we assert a freedom to embrace, to profess, and to observe the religion which we believe to be of divine origin, we cannot deny an equal freedom to choose minds who have not yet yielded to the evidence which has convinced us. James Madison.
We turn our attention next to the Washington Monument. Newt Gingrich, in Rediscovering God in America, the book, observes that the, quote, "It is poignant that the first rays of sun that illuminate our nation's capital each morning first fall upon the eastern side of its tallest building, the 555-foot monument to the father of our country. And there on its top, inscribed in the eastern side of the four-sided aluminum capstone, are the Latin words, Laus Deo, praise to God. These simple words were placed there for the eyes of heaven alone," are a fitting reflection of George Washington's deep conviction that the securing and maintaining of American liberty is owed to divine blessing for which Americans should humbly give thanks. Here's the Washington Monument.
Our walking tour next leads us to one of the most popular attractions in our capital city, the Washington Monument.
From its base to its aluminum capstone, this memorial dedicated to our first president is filled with references to our Creator. This is no coincidence, as Washington's writings contain numerous references to God.
Reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. George Washington.
You know, the religion of Washington is a pretty controversial subject today, and it's something that scholars don't always agree on. I personally believe that Washington was a man of great faith. I think faith was very important to him. I think in his writings he uses the words providence and the helping hand of God over and over and over again.
No people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than the people of the United States. George Washington.
The words "under God" come first of all from George Washington himself. In his general orders to the army, he said to his troops, "You must understand that now you are under God, the only defense of our liberties." If you don't have a munitions factory, army, or navy, you better have faith in divine providence. You don't have a lot to go on, and he did.
When Washington took the oath of office on April 30th, 1789, he asked that the Bible be opened to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 28. Immediately following the oath, Washington added, "So help me God." He bent forward and kissed the Bible before him. Washington then delivered America's first inaugural address, in which he made note of America's indebtedness to our Creator.
In his inaugural address, he says that God touched us every step of the way to this victory. And so there's no one who more quickly and more strongly recognized that God was on our side, and without him, we simply would not have won.
A When the Washington Monument was completed in 1884, it became the world's tallest structure at 555 feet. The day was commemorated by a ceremony placing a capstone at the top of the monument. The east side of the capstone is inscribed in Latin, Laus Deo, which means praise be to God.
And I think he loved the fact that the top of it had the inscription, give praise to God, because that's what Washington did at every point in his life.
Thomas Jefferson is considered to be the least religious of all the founders, but you wouldn't be able to tell that by going through the memorial that was built in his honor. Check it out.
Those who have not been to the Jefferson Memorial may find it surprising to see it included in a walking tour.
After all, Thomas Jefferson was the author of the famous letter calling for a wall of separation between church and state. However, while Jefferson often stressed the importance of questioning all things, including the existence of God, his writings and the way he governed make it clear. Jefferson believed that American liberty relied on the protection of divine providence.
It was not until 1934 that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt persuaded Congress to honor our third president with a memorial.
Upon entering the Jefferson Memorial, inscribed below the dome, are the following words written by Thomas Jefferson.
I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Thomas Jefferson.
This is one of the most self-denying views of liberty in the history of the human race, because it doesn't ask, were Jews or Christians one liberty and something else for everybody else? No. It says, the liberty this God cares about belongs to all, even if they turn against God. God made us so. So it belongs to atheists, Hindus, Muslims, and so forth. Everybody together.
Of the four panels inside the dome, three contain references to God.
People don't understand that Jefferson had a great appreciation for religion and a great love of God. He's often kind of written off as he didn't really care. He was a staunch believer in separation of church and state. He was a staunch believer in individual religions being allowed to flourish in America with equanimity. But he was not somebody who had a kind of just flat out disbelief that there was some kind of higher being. It sometimes gets miswritten about and mistalked about in our society.
You point to treaties with Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States, 1803, the treaty he negotiated with the Kaskaskia Indians. He used federal funds to pay for missionaries to go live among the Indians, and Jefferson also used federal funds to pay for churches to be built in which the Indians could worship. And he didn't see a problem with that, and he's supposed to be the strict separationist.
Jefferson himself denied those who claimed he was hostile toward religion. In a letter to a colleague, Jefferson wrote,
my views are the result of a life of inquiry and reflection, and very different from that anti-Christian system imputed to me by those who know nothing of my opinions. Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to the Danbury Baptists that in modern days has often been misunderstood and really distorted as to its meaning. The Danbury Baptists were concerned that the government was somehow going to interfere with their form of worship. And so they requested the president to write to them and explain to them his views on this aspect of it. And he made it clear when he talked about a separation of church and state, it was to keep government, to keep the state from interfering with religion. It was not to separate the public or public activities from religion, or to keep religion out of the public square.
Now we're going to take a look at the Supreme Court building next, and it really gets interesting considering that in recent years we have seen really an increasing hostility from the courts against public displays of religion or public religious expressions. You know, we've all seen and heard of the courts removing the Ten Commandments from schools and students not being allowed to pray before football games or at graduation ceremonies or use the name Jesus in their valedictorian speeches. But the truth is, the fact is that throughout most of our history, the decisions of the Supreme Court have actually recognized the fact that we are a religious nation, and they have upheld the free expression of religion in the public square. For example, in 1952, in the case of Zorach versus Clausen, the court upheld that a statute that allowed students to be released from school early in order to attend religious classes. Justice William O. Douglas wrote, "We are a religious people, and our institutions presuppose a supreme being. When the state encourages religious instruction or cooperates with religious authorities by adjusting the schedule of public events to sectarian needs or to religious needs, like Bible classes, it follows the best of our traditions. We cannot read into the Bill of Rights a philosophy of hostility to religion." Ironically, even though it has been hostile to religious and public religious expression, the Supreme Court building itself is filled with displays of religion.
The United States Supreme Court is located just across the street from the Capitol. Climbing the steps to the main entrance above the portico, one can see the inscription, "Equal Justice Under the Law."
Cass Gilbert, the architect, took his basic model for the Supreme Court building from the Parthenon in Greece, which of course started its long life as a temple. And really, the Supreme Court is a kind of temple and has come to be known in the common parlance as our temple of justice.
Recent years have seen increasing hostility from the courts to public displays of religion. Ironically, the U.S. Supreme Court is filled with religious symbolism.
The Supreme Court is really full of imagery of religious and secular lawgivers from throughout history, from all times and all places. Moses figures very prominently in the sculptures and pediments and friezes of the Supreme Court. Of course, he was the great Hebrew leader and the one to whom God gave the Ten Commandments. In fact, the Ten Commandments themselves are depicted in one of the friezes of Moses. Solon, the great Greek lawgiver, Confucius, to bring in the Eastern tradition, and the fact that all of these great figures, including Muhammad, are depicted throughout the friezes and sculptures of the Supreme Court, I think really shows the universality of law, and indeed kind of weaves together the fact that all law comes from a common source. Every session of the Supreme Court opens with an invocation, which is essentially a prayer. The marshal stands up and says, "God save the United States and this honorable court." Like much of our law, the roots stem back to the common law in England. And of course, in England, what was commonly said in courtrooms was, "God save the king." But as we said in the Declaration of Independence, the source of all of our law, the source of our rights, is our creator, God. And so now the phrase, the invocation, the prayer that opens every court session is, "God save the United States and this honorable court."
Now, we're going to look at the Roosevelt Memorial next, and things start getting interesting when you get to the Roosevelt Memorial. It was completed in 1997, and it really reflects the decline of religion in America and the advancement of the secular progressive agenda. Planning on it started in 1955, just 10 years after Roosevelt died. And it stalled for a while in the 60s, in 1960. And its design is really distinct and unique from all the other monuments on the National Mall. Instead of a single memorial like the Lincoln and the Washington and the Jefferson like we've seen, it really is made up of four open-air rooms that walk the visitors through the major challenges of FDR's four terms as president. And it really covers the era of the Great Depression, World War II. But here's the interesting thing. is that it also depicts the subtle erosion of our religious foundation and the advancement of secularism. In stark contrast to the numerous references to God and Creator in the Bible in all the other monuments throughout Washington, there's only one reference to God in the Roosevelt Memorial. And so if you were to drop in to the Roosevelt Memorial in isolation of all the other monuments and buildings and memorials in Washington, you would conclude that religion played a very insignificant part in the life and the history of our country, just by reading and observing that particular monument. It also really evidences that political correctness is alive and well. Political correctness is really evident there. For one, a major factor is that FDR is depicted in a wheelchair. Now, in real life, he would never allow himself to be seen in public in a wheelchair. In his mind, as a president of the United States, he believed that appearing in public in a wheelchair conveyed weakness, and he never allowed it. And there's something missing in the monument, in the FDR Memorial. It's that almost ubiquitous cigarette that he had. That picture up there with him, this broad grin, teeth clenched tightly around a cigarette holder and smoking a cigarette, was almost a trademark of FDR. In fact, you see that pose there, that jutted out chin and that cigarette sticking out there. I mean, I've seen that just blacked out, no facial features at all, and you know who it is. I mean, it's like it's his trademark, and it's gone, because smoking, of course, is not good. It's not politically correct. So you see some subtle changes in the shift in our corporate mindset and worldview, even in the Roosevelt Memorial. When we get to the Vietnam Memorial, man, it is an eye-opener. It is a very telling commentary on the state of our nation. On July 1st, 1980, Congress authorized the construction of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial next to the reflecting pool near the Lincoln Memorial. Originally, you can see in that center picture, that's not a stealth bomber. That is the memorial. It was just originally two black marble walls known as the Wall of Names rising up out of the ground. They were completed in November 1982. And that's all there was. It was so stark that for many, the walls looked more like two black scars rising up out of the ground than it did a memorial to honor our dead. And the outward ends on the far edges there start about 18 inches high, and then they rise gradually up to about a little over 10 feet in the center where the two walls converge. Now, here's the important story that the Vietnam Veterans Memorial shows us and tells us. There is not one single reference to God, the Creator, or the Bible in the memorial at all. In fact, originally the memorial didn't even have an American flag. It was just these two black scars coming up out of the ground with the names of 58,256 KIA, MIA, or people who had died as a direct result of their wounds received in combat. An American flag was later added after some veteran group raised enough commotion about it. And then in November 1984, the statue of the three servicemen that you see down there in the left corner was added. And then in 1993, the Vietnam Women's Memorial was also added. Interesting, there's no reference to God, faith, Creator, Bible, nothing. And that is kind of like, that's our government representation there. And what I find interesting is that the people themselves bring those references to the memorial. And they have collected thousands and thousands of scripture verses and crosses and menorahs and all kinds of religious symbols that the people brought of their faith and left there. But the memorial itself is devoid of any reference to God at all. And so if you dropped into, you know, it's really when you look at the rest of the memorials, and we've only looked at four, but if you look at the rest of them, this one stands out in stark contrast to all those others that are really testaments to God's continued involvement in our nation's founding and survival. And so if you were to drop into the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in isolation of all the other memorials, you would conclude that this represents an atheistic people who are devoid of any sense of God, morality, or patriotism. What a contrast. What a monumental move away from God to total secularism. Now, what happened? How did we go from you know, the Washington Monument and praise be to God to this? Well, in a word, the 60s. I hate to blame everything on the 60s, but it's true. I did my master's thesis on why there is so much violence in the schools today. And in my research, I concluded that in the 40s and 50s, those decades were really characterized by a lot of talk about God and church attendance. Man, church attendance was like the norm. The problem was there was very little substance to people's faith. Our culture had become like Jude and Peter described the false teachers, who looked good on the outside, but they lacked any godly substance on the inside. We became, as Peter says in 2 Peter 2:17, springs without water. Or like Jude says in Jude 12, clouds without rain. We had an appearance of religiosity, but there was no substance inside. We had, as Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy 3:5, a form of godliness, but we denied its power. In other words, we had the structure, we had the ritual and all those outward forms of religion, but we denied God and His authority in our lives. And preceding the 60s, the radical left infiltrated the universities, even co-opting universities that were started as seminaries and Christian schools, and they began inculcating our youth with the secular progressive worldview and denigrating the Christian foundation that had made us a great nation. And as the children of the 60s looked at the hypocrisy of their parents and grandparents and this form of godliness with no substance to it, they decided, man, we're not going to play. This is plastic banana, good time rock and roll, and they threw the whole thing off. And they declared God dead, and they did their own thing. The 60s are unique in that, unlike any other time in our history, this era marked a seismic shift that is really hard to overstate its impact. A seismic shift that moved us from moral absolutes to relativism, from moral absolutes to values. And you need to appreciate how big a deal this is. This is monumental. This is gigantic. Now, let's put this in perspective here and try to give you an idea what I'm talking about. At no time was our nation or our leaders or our founders ever perfect. In fact, some of them were downright sinful. Some of them were adulterers and brawlers and drunks and liars and even slave owners. Thomas Jefferson abhorred slavery, and he wrote this. He said, "The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the part, and the degrading submissions on the other. And with what curse should the statesman be loaded who, permitting one half of the citizens thus to trample on the rights of the other? And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis and conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with His wrath?" He's saying if we violate those God-given inalienable rights, we stand in line to receive the wrath of God. Indeed, he said, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever. Jefferson indeed did tremble for his country, but that's not all he trembled for. He trembled for himself as well because he owned slaves. And here's the thing. Here's the point. Don't miss this. This is the crux of why our country is in the trouble it's in. Jefferson knew that what he was doing was wrong. He did it anyway, but he knew that it was wrong. You could confront him on the evils of slavery, and there would be no argument with him about right or wrong, the right or wrong of his behavior. In fact, he even wrote at one point, you know, this is wrong and I'm afraid. I hope God goes easy on me, but I really need the money. I need the free labor. I mean, that's essentially was his position. But the thing is, he knew it was wrong. And the point isn't that the people back in the good old days never crossed the line. The point is that they knew where the line was. The Civil War wasn't fought over competing values. It was fought because Abraham Lincoln knew that slavery was wrong. There was a common, universal moral standard that all Americans understood and that provided a common moral foundation upon which the country was built. In fact, Neil Ronk, who is the senior guide and historian at Christ Church in Philadelphia, says they, the founders, were very knowledgeable. Even the most skeptical founders, in terms of religious dogma, would have known their Bible backwards and forwards. And so in the 60s, the blurring of the line between right and wrong really began in earnest. And today it has all but been erased. An example of this happened to me a few years ago while I was still doing the youth pastor here. And I was asked to preview a video, a date rape prevention video. I think it was for the Women's Center. And in this video, the scenario was this. There was two young women, college age, that were roommates and buddies, had their own apartment, shared this apartment. And then two guys, same age, were also buddies, and they go over to the girl's place, you know, to make the hookup. One of the couples goes upstairs and takes the bedroom. The other couple elects to stay downstairs and they start getting it on. Everything's going fine. They're having a blast downstairs. But upstairs, in the middle of foreplay, the girl decides, I don't think I like this. And she says no. And all of a sudden, the rules change. And this guy is arrested and tried for date rape. Now, I'm not going to excuse what he did. It's wrong. He should have been tried. My point is this. When you adopt relativism, when you adopt this system of values that compete with one another, you no longer have a moral absolute foundation upon which to say that is wrong. His behavior wasn't just a matter of his values versus hers. It was wrong. And the guy downstairs having a good time where everything was still cool between the two of them, he was just as wrong. The line was back at the front door when they entered into there with that game plan in mind. And I don't want to make excuses for the guy, but think about this. All through his junior high and high school years, he had been taught that your hormones are so powerful, the sex drive in you young men are so powerful, it's unreasonable to ask you to abstain from sex until you're married. And so we got to make provisions for you so that you don't get in trouble over your, well, we can't call it misbehavior because it's just values. And now, all of a sudden in this room, in the middle of foreplay, he's supposed to be able to put on the brakes. Here's my point. We cannot live with that kind of ambiguity. Any people, we need the lines. Even if we cross them, we need to know where the line is. Even when we get off track, we need to know where the tracks are so we know where to get back to. And that's what we've lost. And that's where we are today. Now, we have been warned over and over again, and we've read a lot of the warnings in this series, that the only way we can remain a free people is to be a moral people. If we will not place ourselves under God's authority and His absolutes that says this is right, this is wrong, and restrain ourselves, somebody else will do it for us. And as I've thought about that, I thought, you know, the morality train kind of left the station a long time ago, and yet we're still free. I mean, I feel free, don't you? We're free, right? Well, maybe not. Depends on what freedom is. And I thought of this great example. These three big volumes, you know, Brainiac books, are the equivalent in size, a number of pages, of just our health care bill that we just passed. This is it. Good luck reading and digesting that in 3 days. But that's beside the point. This doesn't even include the volumes upon volume that's of rules and regulations that are going to be spun out of this in interpretation of this. This is our health care bill. This is the Constitution of the United States and the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation. These are the documents that set this whole thing up that have governed us for 234 years. This little thing. I can even get through this. Have we lost our freedoms? What do you think? See, they patterned themselves after Genesis. God said, He didn't give them, you know, this 2,500 pages of rules and regulations for living in the Garden of Eden. He said, just don't eat that fruit from that tree. Do anything else you want to do. That's basically what our founders said. They said, we can't run roughshod and control you anyway. Here are the parameters. Live within them. Do anything you want. But do what is right, or you will get this. That's what they were talking about. You see, the only basis for telling that date raper that he is wrong, really, is the moral absolutes that God gives us, saying, you're both wrong. You shouldn't be there. Anything else is arbitrary, and it's just, it doesn't make sense to them. What he did made perfect sense to him philosophically. And so today, we find ourselves buried in rules and regulations, and the political correctness police run roughshod over us and intimidate us into silent submission. Well, there's a lot more that could be said and needs to be said, but we're constrained by the clock. So let me wrap up with four things that I would like you to take home from this message. Number one is be thankful. Thank God, especially this Thanksgiving season, but thank God often for our nation and the freedoms that we still enjoy. I think that is one of the many errors that we have made as a nation. We have forgotten what God has done for us. And we have not been thankful. That's the same mistake that Israel made and that we read about in Judges 2. They forgot who God was and they forgot what He had done for them. In fact, in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 28, we read about how humanity has fallen into God's displeasure. And in verse 21, Paul says that although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him. And so their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. In other words, they refused to acknowledge God and His authority over them, and they were not thankful for what He had done. Verse 28 says, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, God gave them over to a depraved mind. In other words, He gave them what they wanted, and it was their undoing. I think we're on the same course for the same kind of future. Number two, repent and be the moral people who God can bless. You know, I'll admit, sometimes I feel like it's too late. I feel like that we're not just teetering on the brink of destruction. I feel like we have sailed over the edge and we're just waiting for the crash landing. But the Bible reveals God is a God of hope. He's a God of second and third and fourth chances. And clear back in Deuteronomy, as Israel is preparing to enter the land of Canaan, he knows they're going to mess up. And so he tells them, when all these blessings and cursings, the ones that Moses had just delineated in the preceding chapters, when all these things that I have set before you come upon you, because you're going to mess up, and you take them to heart, when you finally, because of the pain that it causes you, and you wake up, and when your children, you and your children return to the Lord your God to obey him with all your heart, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you. You read through the book of Judges, and man, that happens over and over and over. God never slams the door totally on us. Not yet, anyway. Now, we're not Israel, and although, like Israel, we have been blessed beyond any reasonable measure, and I think it's because of our foundation, frankly, and this is not a direct promise to the USA. It's a direct promise to Israel. But I believe the principle is applicable, and that's that God blesses nations that honor him and humble themselves before him. Remember when Jonah warned the people of Nineveh in Jonah chapter 3 of God's impending judgment upon them, they responded by humbling themselves and repenting. And so God in turn responded. And it says when God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he relented and did not bring upon them the destruction he had threatened. See, God keeps the door open as long as he can. And as people, as a people, corporately, we need to ask God's forgiveness and return to our foundations. Return to the faith of our fathers. Number three, fight for your freedom. Now, I'm not talking primarily about a political battle. It does involve politics, obviously, because that's such a big part of our life and the governing of this nation. But I'm talking about that this is primarily a battle between opposing worldviews that are competing for the hearts and minds of people, much like the battle that the first century found themselves in opposing the Roman Empire and its philosophies. And by fight, I simply mean get off the bench and get involved. Get in the game. If we individually do not take responsibility for our future, we'll lose our country as we have known it. We each one have to say, I am part of the problem and I'm part of the solution, and take responsibility for that. Now, if you like the direction that we're going, you don't have to do a thing. Just sit back and watch the parade. But if you want this country to get back on track, you must stop being passive spectators and become engaged in the battle. And by fight, I mean study. We need to learn about our history. Learn how to discern the times and the messages that are bombarding you and your children and your grandchildren daily. By fight, I mean write letters. Write letters to the editors, to the state and national leaders. Write letters encouraging and complimenting people that get it right and those leaders that really take a courageous stand. Encourage them. By fight, I mean vote. Vote for people of character. By fight, I mean support the candidates and the organizations that are on the front lines in the public venue. If our way of life is worth saving, then it's worth sacrificing for. Sometimes, though, I do feel like it's hopeless. But Nancy Piercy, in her new book, Saving Leonardo, gives this bit of encouragement. She says, how did the early church supplant those diverse and often hostile ideas of the Roman Empire that they were in? Well, it studied, critiqued, argued against, sometimes adapted, and finally overcame them. Individuals also demonstrated their commitment by authentic living to the point of sacrifice and death. You see, that's pretty important. People are not going to be drawn to a cloud without rain or a spring without water. We have to be people of substance, and we have to live authentic Christian lives. Our spirituality has to be the real deal, or it's going to be worthless. Our kids are going to do like the 60s kids did. One of the most amazing success stories in history is the way Christianity supplanted classical religions and worldviews to emerge as a leading influence on Western culture. Last of all, teach your children and grandchildren. Teach them who God is, what he has done for our country, what he has done for you. Give them the resources to fight back, books, CDs, DVDs that will inform them and give them a backdrop of knowledge against which they can evaluate the philosophies that are coming at them. And whether you accept it or not, we're in an all-out battle for the hearts and minds of our nation, our children, our grandchildren. And it's time that we take this seriously and we get engaged, or it's over. I want to close by listening one last time to the voices of some of our past leaders and listen intently to their words of wisdom. May God bless America once again because we have become a people who can be blessed.
Our walking tour reminds us that our Creator is the source of our American liberty. On parchment, in rock, mortar, and marble, this belief is preserved for future generations.
I think the religious and moral supports to government are just as important as they ever were. And so if religion supports personal virtue, and if personal virtue supports civic virtue, then religion is important to the successful functioning of our republic.
And it's worth knowing that we're the only nation in the world that's been under the same piece of paper for more than two centuries now. We need to know that we're different because the ideas. And so the next generation needs to know those ideas.
Our founding fathers were firm in their conviction that American liberties were a gift from God, not man. They were equally convinced that our continued political liberty would be tied to our continued religious liberty. That is why those who seek to weaken religious liberties in this country are threatening the very foundation of American civilization.
I think it's extremely important that young people today and young people in future generations understand the history and the significance of the founders, what their lives were like, the heroism that they showed, the great patriotism that they demonstrated. All of these things are an important part of understanding how our country came to be one of the freest and most prosperous nations in the history of the world.
I think it's very important for every citizen of this country, maybe everybody in the world, to read every now and then the founding documents of our country, the Declaration and the Constitution, to see how we balance the role of religion, the role of government, to be inspired by the fact that they use religion to pull us together, not to tear us apart, and to be inspired by their tolerance, their notion that no matter what you felt about God, what you felt about religion, you could be part of a civic society.
One of the great dilemmas our nation's having is that we somehow have learned to deprioritize our own story. People often will accuse a historian of being a triumphalist if you say America's been great, but look at all the amazing accomplishments this country's done.
We're unique among the nations in seeing the spirit of religion and the spirit of liberty as interdependent together. This isn't the way it was in Europe or is now in Europe or Japan or in any other part of the developed world. It's our particular inheritance.
Let us raise a standard to which the wise and the honest can repair. The rest is in the hands of God. George Washington. Religion and virtue are the only foundations, not only of republicanism and of all free government, but of social felicity under all governments and in all combinations of human society. John Adams.
Surely God would not have created such a being as man with an ability to grasp the infinite, to exist only for a day. No, no. Man was made for immortality. Abraham Lincoln.
We believe that all men are created equal because they are created in the image of God.
If we ever forget that we're one nation under God, then we will be a nation gone under.
Thank you, John. Let's take a few moments to collect the offering, and while we do that, And remember that in the back we have some tables. We have angel tree and Christmas spaghetti lunch. I mean, Christmas brunch, Thanksgiving spaghetti thing. Somewhere in there. Check out the tables.